Hi, this is Jerry Conway, and you're listening to Amazing Spider Talk.
Two men who know the angles, uncover and untangle all the questions and the webs left out to tangle. Be in 1962, last Wednesday's afternoon, they'll bend your ears with reckless self-abandon. The Amazing Spider Talk. The Amazing Spider Talk. Come swing through the air, sit back and prepare for the Amazing Spider Talk.
Hello and welcome to the Amazing Spider Talk. My name is Dan Gavosdin, and I'm the editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
And I'm Mark Giannacchio, founder of Chasing Amazing Blog and a current editor and writer at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody, for a special Spider Talk and their Amazing Friends episode of the show. We hope you enjoy this podcast and that it provides an intelligent conversation between two fans and a creator as we hope to look at the Spider-Man comic universe in a bit of a bigger picture.
Yeah, Dan, and for this episode, we will be talking to a recurring guest and friend of the show, Jerry Conway, the storied Spider-Man writer, murderer of Gwen Stacy, current writer of the recently completed Spiral miniseries and the upcoming Carnage series.
Yeah, we're really excited to talk to him, but as always, remember, if you hear this sound, please check out your iOS device for a link to an article, video, or image to enhance your listening experience.
All right, Dan. Well, Jerry's got some pretty cool insights about what went into his Spiral series, what to expect in Carnage, and we even got to ask him a little bit about the upcoming Punisher and Netflix Daredevil. So why don't we just go right to the interview and that great Amazing Friends theme song.
His amazing friends, Iceman and Firestar.
Hey, this is Mark Giannacchio with Dan Gavosdin, and we got a special guest here on Amazing Spider Talk. We have a returning guest. It's Jerry Conway, the legendary writer. I know, Jerry, you don't like always being called a legend, but we'll keep using it here until it's otherwise told not to do it anymore. Jerry, we want to talk to you a little bit about your recently concluded Spiral arc on Amazing Spider-Man, as well as your upcoming Carnage series. But why don't you also just let the listeners out there know some of the other things you're known for. We won't mention the obvious. We'll let you do that one.
Okay. Well, this is, of course, Jerry Conway, and I was the creator of The Punisher. We can get that out of the way. Killed off Gwen Stacy in Amazing Spider-Man 121, I think it was, and I'm the co-creator of Firestorm, which is appearing on Flash and Legends of Tomorrow this season, and a variety of other characters over the years.
That's got to be really exciting to see Firestorm on TV.
It is. It's especially exciting to see that it's the original setup of the characters of Ronnie Raymond and Professor Stein, who share Firestorm's powers. So it's kind of cool. It's been a really weird experience seeing all this stuff that I did 35 years ago or whatever suddenly becoming pop culture material. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that when you were thinking of, you know, characters that you've created that would go on to become pop culture phenoms, you know, Firestorm probably wasn't the top of the list at the time,
no,
right?
I mean, no, I always figured that that was one character that would never be adapted anywhere because, you know, we were so self-conscious about the idea of doing a character that would encourage kids to set their hair on fire. So we just figured, well, maybe in the comics it'll be okay, but, you know, nobody in the mainstream media is ever going to do anything with this. And immediately it was on on Saturday morning cartoons, and then went on. Now it's on network TV, so it's kind of surreal.
After Guardians of the Galaxy, like, no character is too obscure to be made into something.
Absolutely. Well, you know what it reinforces to me is the knowledge that everybody has a favorite character from their childhood, and those characters may seem, you know, kind of inexplicable if they were not part of your childhood, but you can always find a way to enhance them and update them into the modern era. I mean, in my case, I'm very fortunate that Jeff Johns was a big fan of the Detroit Justice League, so here we are, and I have, you know, characters like Vibe being brought back as a mainstream character on The Flash, and that's just strange, you know. It's just strange, but it's wonderful.
Well, definitely. Well, I'm actually a really huge fan of The Flash and looking forward to the second season. But we want to talk Spider-Man with you, Jerry, because that's what we're nerds about. I guess it's a little more obvious of a one. You probably get asked far more Spider-Man questions than Firestorm ones.
Absolutely.
But last month, a five-part miniseries, Spiral. Well, it was. Do we count it as a miniseries, Dan? It's like that weird, the point one series, whatever you want to call it, continuity be damned, just concluded. And you wrote all five parts of that. It kind of brought Spider-Man back to the underworld with a gang war with Hammerhead and Tombstone and Mr. Negative and Black Cat. And you know, it's funny, when I met you at New York Comic Con in October, Jerry, there was just some news starting to leak that you were going to be working on something. And I was just in small talk, said, "Oh, I heard you're working on something." You're like, "I can't talk about it right now." you know, now that the cat's obviously way out of the bag, just to, you know, kind of go back to the beginning here, how did Spiral come together? I mean, was this something that you had been kind of sitting on, or did Marvel come to you and say, "Hey, we want to do street level Spider-Man"? What was the genesis of this storyline?
Well, we were talking about the idea of me doing something for Marvel, and obviously the character that I was most associated with was Spider-Man. So Axel Alonso put me in touch with the editor of Spider-Man at that time. And he and I talked about broad strokes, what would we like to do? And I said, you know, I with all of the storylines of these world-shattering, world-shaking storylines that were going on in Spider-Man, I felt like we had missed a dimension of Spider-Man that was important to the character, which was his down-to-earth battling of crooks. You know, I mean, that it's not all interdimensional fun and games. You know, it's he started out as a guy who was trying to catch thieves and robbers, and things slowly escalated from there. And I always felt that was a venue that he worked well in. So my initial pitch was, can I do something that's set in a street level environment? And they were happy with that. And then the notion that I had is, doing the story, I knew that I was not going to be able to focus on anything that would affect Peter Parker or Spider-Man, because it was going to be a sidebar story no matter what I did. So with that being the reality, I had to approach it the way that I had approached Web of Spider-Man and Spectacular Spider-Man when David Mitrolani was writing Amazing Spider-Man, which was to focus on a supporting cast as my main characters whose stories I would be following. And with that in mind, I thought I'd like to do an arc that featured a good character going bad. And we talked over, they liked that idea. We talked over which character that might be. I wanted to write a female character, and I thought it would be interesting to take someone like Yuri Watanabe, who was kind of peripheral, but, you know, still had come back into Spider-Man's orbit in the previous year or so during the Superior Spider-Man arc. and see what would happen if someone who was committed supposedly to the good, you know, a good orientation, you know, like if you're and put her in a situation where a series of spiraling bad decisions just left her at the end of the series as one of the bad guys. And they liked the idea, so that's what we did.
And, like, you created, like, Hammerhead and Tombstone, and you wrote, like, the Lobo Brothers Gang War. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it about these kind of, like, street-level or gang-related stories that you
that
like the most? Yeah.
Well, because that's actually the era of Spider-Man that I started reading the character. I started reading Spider-Man with, I think, issue 6 or 7. And the first real focused multi-part story was the Crime Master story.
Sure.
That was, I think, issues like 13, 15, something like that, somewhere in there. And I loved it. You know, I mean, I loved the aspect of the kind of Dick Tracy aspect to some of Spider-Man's villains. And when I came onto the book in the early 70s, the character was still pretty down to earth. You know, it hadn't really fought any truly enormously superpowered villains. I think the highest, you know, his biggest, most powerful characters that he fought were people like Doc Ock and Sandman. Maybe Sandman had the biggest powers, you know, that he had to fight. So when John and I were talking over stories to do, we both talked about the idea of doing Dick Tracy type villains, and one of the first that we came up with was Hammerhead. Again, so that I could recapture my youth and go back and do the kind of story that I like to read, the kind of crime master type story. So that was a big part of the appeal to me of those characters. I've always seen Spider-Man as most effective when he's cracking jokes and punching characters rather than when he's flying around in space and dealing with cosmic forces. To me, that's sort of a mismatch. But, you know, the fans like it, so who am I to judge?
And I feel like it's moved more towards that. I mean, we've had a decade where Spider-Man was an Avenger, and I mean, you know, even with mm-hmm. the recent Marvel Sony deal with the cinematic universe, I mean, you know, the end game is going to be Spider-Man with the Avengers fighting Thanos. So it's like there seems to be that pull in that direction. Yet, I mean, you know, reading something like Spiral, and, you know, I know Dan agrees with me. I mean, it just felt very organic in terms of this is Spider-Man, you know. I don't know how you reconcile that in terms of where the character has gone and, you know.
As I say, this was a sidebar story, so we had the freedom to do something like this. I mean, I recognize, too, to a degree, Dan Slott is made us all very aware that those old street level characters are no longer a serious threat to Spidey. You know, we've seen we have like that bar that the Black Cat owns where they all hang out and you know, compare bruises and wounds, and it's one of my favorite of the Superior books was the Superior Foes of Spider-Man, where, you know, the five loser villains, you know, hang out together and perform badly in crimes. I mean, I find that very amusing, but it's also at the same time kind of disheartening because these characters used to be serious threats that could occupy Spidey for an issue or two of high drama, you know, and now they're really, to be perfectly blunt, you know, really minor weak T villains compared to what he has to face on a, you know, when he does a story like the, when he faces opponents like he did in the Spider-Verse series. So Yeah, this, to, if anything, was probably more of a nostalgic tip of the hat to an old vision of Spidey that, that we'll probably not see again for a while. But that was kind of what my brief was, you know, to do that.
You're breaking Mark and I's hearts, I think, here.
Well, you know, mine too. I mean, you know, honestly, I like that. I like what they do. It's sort of weird. You know, you read both. If you've been around a long time, as I have, as you guys have, you know, you've seen the character go through a lot of different changes. And you know that we're constantly seeing new readers come in who have different sets of expectations than older readers, and you have to answer those expectations as a publishing company. You can't, you know, force them to read things the way that you might want them to read things. You know, the readers decide. And this book, I think, did pretty well. But one of the reasons I think it did relatively well is because of the numbering as a point series. People picked it up, you know, thinking that it was part of the regular Spider-Man continuity, when, as I say, it was a kind of a sidebar. So it benefited from that association. But I think if you took Spider-Man and took him in this direction today, I don't know that the readers would embrace it, you know.
Well, one of the things I want to compliment you on, I don't know if this is necessarily a question, is that you were able to incorporate the superior story into your story and make it maybe not a key part of it, but it informed a lot of his decisions. And that's something that, like, I feel like reading Spider-Man comics today, we just barrel ahead, you know, with very little time to think back. And it was really refreshing to see that in your book.
Well, I had an advantage over Dan too, because while, as I say, since this is a sidebar, I don't have to set things up for the next big, event. You know, I don't have to deal with the repercussions of the last event and, you know, set up the next event. I mean, Dan had two major events that followed one right on after the other. You know, you end up with the Superior Spider-Man storyline, which in a rational universe, you should spend about a year, year and a half dealing with the aftermath of that, because there's a whole series of rich storylines that should be plumbed, resulting from that event. But unfortunately, from a publishing point of view, you have to move on to the next big event, which is Spider-Verse, and then Spider-Verse distracts you from being able to really deal with the repercussions of Superior. And then by the time you're done with Spider-Verse, it's been now a year and a half since Superior. So, like, who remembers what happened then? And I just felt like I had the opportunity to do a little bit of, you know, integration, you know, of the those two events, you know, referencing the questions of choice and responsibility that came out of Spider-Verse with the repercussions of what happened to New York City's underworld as a result of Doc Ock's actions in Superior. So I had that breathing room to do that in, which I don't think Dan had with his books. So it's, maybe this would be a way for Marvel to think about, you know, doing things in the future, is that create a secondary title that deals with the repercussions of the events.
Well, I was going to ask you that, because, I mean, this, they clearly wanted, you know, someone to come in and you wrote this story. Like, I wonder if this is, they have a 1.1 coming out with him dealing with some strange, bizarre zombie threat. But, like, I wonder if they're going to pursue, or if you have any knowledge that they're looking to pursue doing more of these tangential storylines.
Well, I don't think so, because there was some debate over when we first were putting this one together, whether this was going to be a point book or it was going to be a separate mini series, and most of the tie-ins that related to Superior and Spider-Verse were things that I put in, on my own. I wasn't directed to do that.
So it wasn't
like somebody, there was some master plan. The only master plan was it would be fun to do something that's not going to be echoed in the main book and that won't interfere with whatever storyline is going on in the main book. As I say, this is a sidebar, so I really couldn't do anything that fundamentally affected Peter or Spider-Man, you know, that their character development. So I had to work on another character's development.
Right. Well, one of the subplots that you integrated from The Superior and from Dan Slott's run with the ASM reboot was kind of the heel turn and underworld ascent of the Black Cat.
Right.
And, you know, I'm curious, you know, what do you think of that? I mean, like, this is kind of a character turn that, you know, I think some fans have either embraced or have not. And you know, you worked well with it. So I'm just curious, do you see Black Cat in this universe? Or, I mean, what's your take on it?
Well, I think it's fun. I think, you mean, will she show up after Secret Wars? My guess is that they've invested a lot of time and energy into strengthening her as a villainess. So my guess would be that she'll play a fairly prominent role.
Well, I just meant, did you feel comfortable writing her in the fashion that you wrote her as more as a villainess rather than, you know, the flirtatious sidekick or whatever she's been prior to?
Yeah, I thought it kind of worked. I mean, it was it's a way to get some antagonism going, and it gave me a voice to articulate some of the other issues, you know, about what was going on. I think she's an interesting character as a villainess, but as with anything in the Marvel universe or even in the DC universe, we know that this is a temporary situation. there's going to be some evolution at some point where there's going to be a resolution to that. So for right now, it's a fun. A fun take, you know, that I think was relatively properly motivated. I mean, it might have needed a little more strengthening than it had in because of the distraction of the Spider-Verse, interregnum between the end of the Superior Spider-Man arc and the beginning of the post Spider-Verse arc. If we had been able to follow and develop more of Felicia during that period, it might have felt more integrated. But they didn't have that option.
Going from something silly like the Black Cat, or maybe she's not silly, but she's not fairly serious, to something serious. Is your book here, Spiral, was released during the context of all these police officer murders and interactions with citizens and ways that have made the news and I think should be alarming to people.
Sure.
Was this an intentional reflection on these stories that have been happening in America for a long time? And if so, what did you want to say about like the institutional police violence in the country?
Well, two things. I mean, the story was originally plotted about a year and a half ago. We originally started work on this I think in February of last year. So that tells you how far back, you know, this was going.
Sure.
I didn't actually start writing it until probably last summer, which was around when things started to heat up around Ferguson. And that opened the door for, you know, exploring those social issues. But as I mentioned in other interviews, I actually came from a family of police. My uncle was a cop, and my dad had been a policeman. And I was I was raised in that environment, you know, so that it's part of my coding. But I really definitely recognize the issues that operate for guys and women in that world. there's a real problem with the way that police are trained and how they're supported by society. You know, they're a necessary force, but very often they're not given the kind of social support where they can learn how to operate effectively. That's under the best case scenarios. Under the worst case scenarios, like we see in many minority communities, they are basically made to be an occupying force to support the external elite power structure. So it's an even worse situation. In terms of Yuri, what I wanted to get across with her was that she was somebody who saw herself as a cop, and that was her how she identified herself. And what that meant for her personally was that her loyalty was not to the city, and it wasn't to the population. Her loyalty was to other cops. And to the degree that she felt supported by her organization and her fellow police, that's the degree that she felt safe, rational, and fulfilled. And then as that started to break down, and then as she ultimately, you know, was ostracized by that support mechanism, she has nowhere else to go. Many cops, I think, do have a real problem with socialization outside of the police world. You know, I mean, that's their lives. And once they're in effect removed from that, either through retirement or, you know, through some other action, they have no life. they're kind of helpless, and it's sad. But that, of course, doesn't excuse any of the behavior that happens. But it also explains it, because if you're kind of in this very close social network of people who think like you and see the world the way you do and feel antagonistic towards the outside population, you know, the way that you do, you're kind of supported in a crazy mindset. And I don't know if I had sufficient room or sufficient thematic room to make that clear, but that was sort of where I was coming from, you know, in my own point of view on the character.
Certainly, I think a lot of the monologues in Spiral, or I guess like thought monologues from Peter, really, I thought it was really even-handed and not what I was expecting, you know, from a superhero and supervillain book where people are good and bad and shades of gray are often left out in lieu of punching.
Right.
So I found
sometimes all you really want to do is punch them in the face.
Sure. I just found it wholly refreshing.
Well, thanks. I mean, I did try to you try to serve a multitude of masters when you're doing a comic book story. You want to do something that's fun to read, that's going to be entertaining and hopefully pops on the page. But then at the end of the day, you also want to have leave at least some resonance, you know, where people have got something to think about, you know, hopefully. More than the 5 minutes that they spend reading the comic, or the 10 minutes.
Some of us, it takes an hour per issue, Jerry.
Well, then you really get into it. I'm astonished how fast these books read now. I used to spend an afternoon. You know, it's like I used to. Maybe it's just the retrospective being. You know, when you were a kid, the days seem to go on forever. But it always seemed to me that comics took a lot longer to read than they do now.
Well, I think Dan is amazed because, you know, he'll joke with me sometimes about how quickly I read through Brian Michael Bendis's Ultimate Spider-Man, because I had it on the Marvel Unlimited app. And I mean, those books, because especially since they're so kind of decompressed in terms of the narrative, I mean, like you can blow through five of those in like a half hour. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean,
well, also like, Bendis writes such quick, fast, smart dialogue that it flows so quickly. You know, it just zooms along. Yeah.
I'm also reading his Daredevil right now, and that's taking a while because you can read about law, and then you can read Daredevil and really read about law.
Yeah, he varies it according to his to the material, right? You know, he's a very thoughtful writer.
Well, you know, you kind of talked about from a spiral standpoint what you were looking to give readers, and I thought that made a segue into what new work you're gonna be putting out in the coming months, which is this Carnage series.
Yeah,
that's gonna be hitting the racks. Are there still racks? I don't even know anymore.
Somewhere there's a rack. There's one rack left in America.
Get your one spinner rack. In November is the first issue launching, or is it late October?
They don't tell me the dates, but that sounds about right.
We're
halfway through the art on the first issue right now, so. I think Mike Perkins will be done in a couple of weeks with issue one, which means I have to finish issue two. Okay.
Do they send the art to you page by page?
Yes. Yeah, I get to see the pencils and the inks. I mean, it's really neat because, first of all, it keeps you motivated, you know, because the stuff looks so great. But it also allows if you're noticing anything that's trending off from where it needs to go for story purposes, you can at least throw your two cents in and say, guys, we need to put this over here.
Well, Jerry, I think Dan and I were both surprised to hear that your name was attached to a Carnage series. Not as surprised
as I was.
Well, so what happened here? I mean, did you lose a bet or no?
No, not at all. No, actually, I had while we were working on Spiral, Nick Lowe and I really enjoyed working together, and I said, you know, if there's anything you know that we can do after this, I'd be open to it. And he came to me and said, you know, we're thinking of doing a Carnage series. And I was like, oh, how would that actually work? You know, it's like another villain book, you know, didn't seem. And he said, but well, here's the take. It's like what you did when you set up Tomb of Dracula. And I said, oh, I get that. You know, it's like, in other words, Carnage is Dracula in this context. And, our characters are the equivalent of the people that pursued him in Tomb of Dracula, and that was a format that I could see some value to, because you're using Carnage as a kind of a force of nature that passes through the situation, and people are reacting to it, but they're also proactively pursuing him. And each has their own story, and each of their stories interact and hopefully create some drama and friction and character byplay. So once Nick sort of pitched that take to me, I started getting some ideas that I hope, you know, will play off of this. And just using Carnage as a way into a larger story, you know, about these people who are pursuing him.
Anytime a writer says that Carnage is going to be a force of nature, I just want to hug them and say, you got it, because he is just not that interesting of a character, and like, he's very interesting as a force of nature, I think.
Sure. Well, it's in a way, I mean, I'm thinking this as a, first of all, it's not going to be any. I'm not even going to be trying to be quote deep, you know, the way that I was quote deep if I was on Spiral. Spiral was a contained story that was a character arc driven story, and with Carnage, I'm thinking of it more as a. It's a horror series, you know. I know this may have connotations, but I don't. But try to keep those out of your head. But he's the combination of the Freddy Krueger, the Michael Myers, the guy in Saw, you know, who presents the threat. And our story is actually about the people who are dealing with the threat. He is hopefully interesting. You know, I mean, I always found Freddy Krueger, you know, at least in the first and the last Nightmare films, to be kind of interesting because he was over the top, but also extremely menacing and freaky. But he's not. He's more of a because he's absolutely out of his mind. He's not somebody who can drive a story. You know, he can't motivate things because his motivation is chaos. But he can be a motivating force in the same way that Hurricane Katrina is a motivating force. You know, and you want to get out of the path of it, or you want to save people who are in the path of it. And that can lead you to some interesting storylines and character lines for the people who are caught up in that gale force wind.
I mean, are there any Carnage stories that you're leaning on just for some inspiration, or are you just, I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
They basically, this goes back to his first, what springboards this, to a degree, is his first, mass killing, the orphanage fire that, he set back in when he was 12 or 13 years old. This is about the one who got away. And it was a young woman, obviously, oddly enough, since this was a all-boys orphanage. And she is now the head of security at a mine in West Virginia. He sees her on a news broadcast, you know, because they're talking about reopening this mine and after a natural disaster. And he's kind of pissed because, you know, he usually kills everybody he goes after, and he didn't get her. So he goes after her. But it turns out, and this, I'm not giving anything away that you won't discover on page 4 of the first issue. This is a setup. She's bait in a trap, and she is not exactly helpless bait, but she's the cheese for Carnage, who's the rat in this case. And our other characters who are being brought in are John Jameson is going to be one of the continuing characters, and Eddie Brock are part of this group of people who are gathered together under the direction of a FBI special agent to take Carnage down.
And of course, both toxin infested Eddie Brock.
Yes, it is. So,
and I would say, and John Jameson, of course, was the man wolf at one point.
Yes,
so
he was.
So,
I'm teased.
I'm sensing a theme.
Yes, we all have our demons. Let's put it that way.
Jerry, do you turn into a wolf by night?
Well, werewolf by night. And believe it or not, that's part of it too. one of the things I wanted to do is to drag in some old ideas that I'd had from my other horror writing in the past. So some of that stuff is coming up in this too. But I don't want to, you know, give too much of it away, because some of it is going to be pretty obvious right away, but some of it isn't.
Yeah, we don't want to push. We want to be surprised too. So,
yeah, I'm thinking of this. I mean, the way that I'm really approaching this one is, this is a movie. These are supposed to be big set pieces, action and hopefully witty dialogue. Nothing that's going to challenge us too much, you know. But it's going to hopefully be very entertaining. You know, it's a scare fest. You know, that's basically it. And hopefully it'll be scary, and hopefully it'll be fun. You know, and people will laugh at some of the lines, and you know, cringe at others. Hopefully, in all likelihood.
you know, not to keep changing gears on you, Jerry, but you know, you had mentioned at the beginning of the interview that you were the creator of The Punisher, and I just wanted to ask you about this just because, you know, we're starting to get more and more teasers. So we got the recent announcement that The Punisher is going to be a key part of the second season of Daredevil on Netflix. And,
I'm
just curious, you know, we've obviously had some Punisher, pop culture Punisher in, you know, over the last 10-15 years or so with the couple of movies that came out. But, you know, now that it's kind of like back with the Marvel Cinematic Universe and kind of tying into this larger project on Netflix, I mean, what are you anticipating for Punisher on this? And I mean, you have any thoughts on who they cast to play this John Bernthal from Walking Dead? I mean, any reactions to any of this news?
Well, I think it's I don't think Bernthal would have been somebody I would have cast, but he certainly has a great presence. So I'm really excited about that. And honestly, it's got to be, whatever they do is going to be a lot better than what has been done in the past. So I'm hopeful in that sense. I think it's great. I mean, I liked the first season of Daredevil. I had some problems with some of the pacing in it. You know, I felt like the midsection of the series didn't quite hold together. But, you know, generally speaking, I thought it was a pretty dynamite show. And I have a lot of confidence in the second season because from what I've heard, they've got some really top talent behind the scenes. And so I'm excited, you know. It's part of this whole weird, you know, renaissance of material from the 70s and 80s finding its way into the pop culture, you know, of the aughts or the teens now. It's cool, you know. I hope he wears a skull on his shirt, but I haven't seen that so far. So,
he better.
Maybe they'll save it for the last episode.
they're gonna have to do that. It's such an icon now. They would really be missing out if they didn't do that.
They tease us with Daredevil's costume till the very end. So you never know.
Yeah.
And apparently they're even redesigning that too. So who knows.
I'd be glad to hear that because I wasn't that wild about the original. I mean, the version that appeared in that last episode.
Yeah, I think everyone was like, "Let's put the black back on."
Yeah, it just seemed a little ill-fitting. You know, it didn't seem. I don't know, but you know, who am I? I'm not a costume designer. Generally, they've done a pretty darn good job with designing the costumes for the Marvel books.
So speaking of like how people have been portrayed, what are your thoughts on how Punisher has been depicted in pop culture over the years? Like, obviously you seemed to express that you didn't love it, but like, do you have a version that you enjoy, or are they all cringeworthy to you?
Have you seen the 5-10 minute video that Tom Jane did?
Yeah.
Dirty Laundry. I liked that. I thought that was a pretty good version of the Punisher. I think it's a problem because until recently, nobody's quite known how to do that character in terms of tone. You know, you go back to the Dolph Lundgren version. That's just, you know, way off.
Yeah.
And the Thomas Jane version was fine, but you know, it was unbalanced by the characters around him. You know, specifically the John Travolta, you know, character. So finding that right tone, maybe doing it on the small screen, you know, doing it on something that doesn't require a big budget, you know, to justify itself, you know, and it could be more personal and more down to earth. Might be exactly the way to do it. And Netflix, you know, has the advantage of having no real taboos, you know, that they can't, you know, cross. So that could work very well.
I think Kingpin crossed about all of them in the first season.
Yes, yeah. I mean, pretty powerful stuff. I mean, you know, when you've got a guy who like smashes somebody's head with a door, a car door, smashes it to a pulp. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a very violent show. And that's kind of where you have to go with a character like the Punisher. And it should raise questions of, is this right or wrong? You know, is this guy, I mean, he should be a morally ambiguous character. I mean, I know that fans generally look past that, you know, and just admire his determination and takes no prisoners sort of attitude. But he's really a very morally compromised character. I mean, he's somebody who kills without compunction, and there's a bit of a sociopathic side to that. That I think you have an opportunity to explore over 13 episodes that you wouldn't have, you know, in a 2-hour movie where he's got to be a sympathetic protagonist.
Cool. Now, I mean, something that I've always found interesting, and, you know, you could obviously make the same argument with the character Kingpin, but, you know, Punisher, obviously you created him as an adversary for Spider-Man, or at least he first appeared in Spider-Man, but, like, it seems like over the years, you know, first starting with Frank Miller's run on Daredevil and then other creators, he's kind of been co-opted by the Daredevil universe. Now, granted, this is all street level, but we had that conversation earlier about Spider-Man and street level. But my long-winded way of saying is, I mean, do you still see the value in trying to hook up Spider-Man and Punisher either in a movie or in a TV series or something, or do you think that the character's just way too much a part of this other universe now, and to bring it in would probably just cause confusion and angry fans and stuff?
I think he could work in a comic book story. I don't think you could. I don't think a character like the Punisher in, let's say we put him into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, the movie end of things. His power level, but just taking it on that scale, puts him at a level of a character like Hawkeye. So just as Hawkeye has problems being relevant in that universe, a character like Punisher would have problems being relevant in that universe. I'm just talking about power levels, you know, not necessarily character levels.
Oh, of course.
Now, from a tonal point of view, he's way out of, I mean, if you're going to do him correctly, he would be way out of the tone of the Marvel Universe, because the Marvel Cinematic Universe, about the darkest that it's ever gotten, was maybe scenes in Captain America Winter Soldier, you know, where you're talking about, you know, the betrayal of American citizens by their government, you know, that sort of thing, and this kind of general paranoia. That's about as dark as it gets, you know, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So a character like Frank Castle, who, you know, operates very much over the line in a vigilante world, wouldn't fit tonally in that world. But he fits perfectly, you know, in the Netflix Marvel universe, because that is street level and it is, you know, tonally a much darker landscape. So works there, you know, I think.
I think the Avengers need to just go to Hell's Kitchen. The problems there seem to be worse than everywhere else.
Yeah, but it's sort of like it's sort of like shooting flies with a shotgun. You know, the collateral damage would be pretty bad, as we saw. And I think that's a kind of fascinating point that the Netflix shows are going to attempt to address, which is what does a world look like when you're not, you know, when you're not flying over Manhattan to battle the Chiari, but when you're actually down on the ground with the rubble landing around you? You know, we really don't see that. The Marvel universe is a battle of elites, and the Netflix Marvel universe is the real people, and I think that's kind of neat.
We hear a lot from, like, writers and history creators that we've had on our show that writing comics and even drawing comics is a young man's game. Yet here you are, and Spiral sold... It was one of the top-selling books when it was coming out. What do you think has been your key to staying in the game or with Marvel, you know, for so long?
A childish mind. I think you know, keeping your enthusiasm and keeping current, you know, on what's going on is key. A lot of the guys who lose their way, you know, lose their relevance, lose their relevance primarily because they stop enjoying comics, and they enjoy the experience of the comics that they read years and years and years ago, and don't see the value in the new stuff. I'm a big fan of actually a lot of the stuff that comes out now. I'm a huge fan of independent comics and Image comics, and I like a lot of Marvel stuff and a lot of DC stuff. And what attracts me is not, you know, the more, I mean, even though I write in a fairly traditional way, what attracts me as a reader is actually the less traditional comics. So even though I'm writing, you know, a more traditional version of this material, I at least think I'm conscious of what is going on in the more modern and postmodern versions of these things. So I'm not like hopelessly clueless, you know, about the changes. I may choose to ignore them, you know, but at least I know what's going on. I mean, I remember when I was starting out in comics and reading Marvel and DC, you could tell when the books were being written by people who didn't read the current books. You know, people like Bob Haney, who is a very talented writer, and is somebody who was dismissed at the time, you know, as a hack. It wasn't that he couldn't do it. It's that he didn't enjoy comics. You know, he didn't read them for fun. He didn't know what was going on. So his stuff always felt tone deaf. You know, it always felt like it was being written by somebody with a sense of contempt for what was current. And I'm not saying that my stuff is any better or worse than any of my contemporaries, but I really like what's going on in comics for the most part. So I'm enthusiastic about it, and that means that I'm trying to listen to the kind of voices, the way people are telling stories now, the way they're pacing them. And I'm trying to at least be aware of that. And I think that may come across a bit in what I'm doing, hopefully. You know, and whatever tone deaf stuff, you know, creeps in, you know, is just sort of an inevitable result of me being of a different generation. So, but you know, at least I like what's going on, you know, and I think that's something that, I would recommend to any of my contemporaries who want to keep working in the business.
Well, Jerry, I don't know. Dan, do you have anything else you want to throw in there?
No, this has been great. I'm super excited about your Carnage series.
Well, thanks. I hope you enjoy it. Don't expect it to be great literature. It's supposed to be scary and fun. That's the basic idea.
Hey, we're reading the Spider Island miniseries, and I'm enjoying the hell out of that. And it is like as 90s punching monstery as it gets. So, you know, I'm in the mood for more of those monsters. Let's bring it on.
Okay. Yeah, we even have a shout out to the great Captain America Cap Wolf run from the early 90s. So, I mean, cool. Like that's as good as it gets. No, I mean, I think it's great because, you know, it's because we, you know, I think Dan and I have even talked about this when we've addressed Carnage and other times. It's, you know, this idea that he's a monster and it's like, let's just treat him as that, you know, and, mm-hmm. and it sounds like that's what you're doing. So, yep. You know,
yeah, I'm not trying to make him a hero. I'm not trying to get into his deep psychological roots, you know, I'm just trying to make him somebody who's fun to watch do horrible things.
And what's better than that?
Yeah. that is the peak of cultural entertainment.
I would like to think so.
All right. Well, Jerry, do you want to plug anything else for yourself in terms of, you know, either online or website or other work or anything else?
No, people can follow me on Twitter. It's just Jerry Conway, GerryConway, WAY. And I also have a Tumblr, same link. And I write occasionally on that stuff and I'm also going to be doing a Firestorm miniseries after the first of the year, so hopefully that'll come out too and gain some attention.
Excellent. Terrific.
Amazing friend.
Well, thanks again, as always, to Jerry for coming and joining us on the show. Mark, it never fails to, I guess, amuse me, or I don't even know what word I'm looking for here, but that we get Jerry on the show. I mean, a year ago, I couldn't even have fathomed to talk to Jerry Conway, much less have him on our show three times.
I know. I mean, I think I kind of like, on a whim, reached out to him on Twitter, like, want to come on our show? And he was like, oh, yeah, sure. Now I'm like, just email him. Hey, it's me again.
I think you even used the font that made it sound like you, like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this interview was a lot of fun. I had a great time, and I couldn't believe how much he told us about the Carnage story.
Yeah, that series sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to that. I was already, with him being attached to it, I was already looking forward to it. But this should be real fun.
I'm just hoping for some forward movement with Eddie Brock. That's a character I miss quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. But, and I mean, even John Jameson. I mean, you know, we haven't really gotten a Jameson story in a dog's year, pun intended.
I guess, yeah, since like the beginning of Big Time. Yeah, was that like the last time we saw him?
I think so.
Sure. I don't know. Well, of course, guys, you can find all of our new Amazing Spider Talk and old Superior Spider Talk podcasts at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. And you can also find all those old Jerry Conway episodes on there. Those ones are still going to be great listens even now. And of course, you can find us also on iTunes and Stitcher by searching for Amazing Spider Talk. And if you do, please be sure to leave us a comment or a review, as they're a great way to help us grow our community and be discovered by new listeners. And it's been a while since we've gotten one of those, so, you know, we're at 88 of them. Let's push it to 100. Come on, guys. You can help us get there.
Come on, people.
Yeah, and of course, if you have any opinions on the comics that we discussed today or any questions, please be sure to email them to us at AmazingSpiderTalk@gmail.com, and we'll address and read those on the air as well.
Yeah, and while you're checking in on us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Gmail, also be sure to check out both of our Facebook pages at facebook.com/SuperiorSpiderTalk and facebook.com/ChasingAmazing. Dan and I will put up articles. We'll talk about our feelings and what's going on. I'll give updates on Uncle Ben, whether he's alive or dead at the moment. You know, lots of stuff. Flash is recovering from his illness. You know, he thought he just had that he drank the worm in a tequila bottle, and I had to explain to him that no, he had the stomach flu the same as I did.
As always, if you want to follow the adventures of Spider-Gwen and Miles Morales, be sure to subscribe to our sister podcast, The Ultimate Spin, hosted by Brian, Kyle, and Noor. I know they're on a bit of a break because Ultimate, well, it's over, but Miles Morales is on a break. But, you know, check out that show.
Yeah, absolutely. And as always, our theme song is courtesy of Rylan Bojack, and our outro song comes from Magic.
And another special thanks to Nick Cagnetti, Ray Sumser, Ron Friends, and Sal Buscema for our show's artwork. Special note, if you want to prepare for our next Essentials episode, we're going to be discussing Mark's pick. What pick did you have here, Mark?
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about Sensational Spider-Man Annual Number 1, also known as To Have and To Hold. That was the number one Peter and MJ story when I was doing that list on your site recently, Dan. So, yeah, you should read that.
Where can we find you on the internet?
Yeah, well, you can, of course, find me on Twitter at ChasingASMBlog. And, you know, I'm still writing on SuperiorSpiderTalk.com, wrapping up a Spider-Man Fantastic Four countdown and gearing up for more fun features over the next couple of weeks. Dan, what about you? Where can we find you?
Yeah, you can find me the same places on SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. I got my Renew Your Vows number 5 review up today. And, Mark, you haven't even read the book yet, so... That'll be interesting to see your perspective when we record our show tomorrow. And, yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Dan Gavazin or my Spider-Man account at SupSpiderTalk. But, Mark, I wanted to talk to you about this. Your poor Aunt May, she just must be devastated.
Oh, yeah? Why? What happened?
To hear that Uncle Ben died in a mining accident? What a tragedy. Do you think it has anything to do with that dastardly Carnage symbiote?
Yeah, Dan, you know, this was a little sad. Uncle Ben, of course, he's a bit of an environmentalist, or was, you know, with the ponytail and everything. And, you know, he was actually at a coal mine protesting, you know, some fracking.
Is that what they do in coal mines?
Well, you know, it was a natural gas exploration to a neighboring coal mine.
Gotcha.
This is a hotbed of energy here, and you know, Uncle Ben was all like solar power this and wind power that, and then all of a sudden that symbiote just dropped in and was like, "How about some Carnage power?" And you know, honestly, like you would have thought that Carnage murdered Uncle Ben, but Uncle Ben died from rolling his eyes so hard at, like, what kind of cheesy line from Carnage is that? And, like, when is anybody ever going to get Carnage right? He just keeled over and dropped dead because Carnage was just so one note and terribly written. But then Jerry Conway showed up and it was just like, "Oh, Mark, I'm really sorry about your Uncle Ben. But, you know, we're actually going to just have a really fun monster book with Carnage. So I'm sorry again about your Uncle Ben. Go Green Power. And just remember, with great podcasts must also come Amazing Spider Talk."